Next case, United States v. Bennett, Mr. Brindley.
May it please the Court. My name is Beau Brindley, and I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Gregory Bennett. Mr. Bennett entered a blind plea of guilty after having previously entered into a proffer agreement with the United States. The issue I would like to address this morning with the Court is whether the government and the probation office and ultimately the district court breached that proffer agreement with the defendant by relying on his proffer protected statements to calculate the guideline range applicable to his case. Now, it's without dispute that Gregory Bennett entered into a proffer agreement with the government before he ever entered a guilty plea. And that proffer agreement amounted to a contract that this Court says should be strictly construed in its precedent. And it's also beyond dispute that the proffer protected statements that he made were cited by the probation officer in the pre-sentence report as support for the calculation of the guideline range. Now, in the proffer agreement itself, its own language, the proffer agreement explicitly incorporated Section 1B1.8 of the United States Sentencing Guidelines. And Section 1B1.8 explicitly asserts that these kinds of protected statements made by defendants cannot be used for the purpose of calculating the guideline range at sentencing. But it happened. The probation office cited it, and then it went to the district court. Now, after the probation office cited it, Mr. Bennett did raise objections to that.
What evidence do you have that the probation office used his statements from the proffer to make relevant conduct findings, as opposed to statements from Hill or statements about the beating?
Both parties, I think both parties in the briefing agree that in the pre-sentence investigation report, the probation officer referenced explicitly his protected statements and used them as one of the citations in support. Now, that's not to say that the probation officer did not also consider statements from Hill or statements from Kelly or from Green. But one of the things that's there is these proffer protected statements. And it's cited when the probation officer is calculating the guideline range, and that's what you can't do. And so the problem that we have is then we filed objections to that. And the district court and the government took the position, well, your objections, now you're taking a contrary position. But we've only done that after our specific agreement was breached. And pursuant.
No, that's not true. You did it in your email of April 4th.
The emails, Judge, well, first of all, the emails are statements of counsel about a plea negotiation. These statements were never adopted by Gregory Bennett, and they were never made in any judicial proceeding.
Lawyer.
That's
and
true.
You say he didn't do the cocaine, right?
I think I said that the government's evidence was not
with
such that.
He said he maintains. You're speaking on his behalf.
He maintains. Yes.
That he was not selling cocaine.
That is correct.
You represent that to the government as his statement, his position.
I represent it to the government.
Which is inconsistent with the proffer.
As his position, yes. Your Honor, however, if you look at the explicit language of the proffer agreement, that explicit language sets forth the kinds of proceedings where he can take a contrary position. And it says that if your client should subsequently testify at any trial or hearing contrary to the substance of the proffer or presents a position inconsistent with the proffer, then it gives examples of what that would be, Judge. And all those examples all those examples are during cross-examination of witnesses, through witness testimony, or during arguments. It's all within judicial proceedings.
Yeah, but doesn't the for example language tell us that the prohibition is not limited to those situations, for example?
Your Honor, I think that it says those are specific examples. It does not indicate those are the only examples. I agree with that. There could be others. But everything in this clause suggests, if strictly construed, we are talking about statements made within judicial proceedings. I also think it's important to note that the statements back and forth between...
You're saying in your email that you're going to fight the cocaine accusation.
If the government was going to proceed on that charge, we would have. The point of that was...
Well, that would be totally inconsistent with the proffer agreement.
It would have if we had done that.
You're saying you're going to do it.
The point of all of that is negotiation for the purpose of getting the cocaine charge.
Lying in negotiation, is that it?
No, I'm saying that we take...
You are lying because you couldn't do this, right?
We could not have fought it if they
brought
it.
Throw away the whole proffer agreement if you litigated cocaine.
If we went to trial and litigated cocaine, then the proffer statements would have came in, yes. But we didn't have to do that.
That's what you're threatening to do.
Yes. And that is statements made in pursuit of...
That's a proper threat.
In plea negotiations, absolutely, yes.
In plea negotiations, you can repudiate the proffer agreement.
In statements made to a U.S. attorney in plea negotiations are never to be used, plain statements made to the U.S. attorney in plea negotiations, under Rule 11. And those are the statements from that
so
I'm
he signs a proffer agreement. He promises he's telling the truth.
Yes.
And then he says through you, he says the opposite. He says he didn't do cocaine.
We took that position with the government to try to get a dismissal of the cocaine charges.
He repudiated the proffer agreement in an effort to do better. Yeah.
We did not repudiate the proffer agreement. What we did was...
It requires a completely truthful statement by your client. Now, that means your email is false. Because in your email, you represent him as having repudiated what he said in the proffer agreement. So that means that the proffer agreement is false, or your email is false. One of the two.
That's true, Your Honor. There is a dissonance between the proffer agreement.
You think this is proper, what you've done.
In the process of negotiating to get a charge...
You can lie and you can do anything you want in a negotiation, right?
No one was lying, Judge. We were taking a different position.
Yes, lying.
No.
Look, he either lied here when he said he did the cocaine, or he lied through you in the email when he said he didn't do the cocaine. So which is it?
I have no idea whether he did the cocaine or not, Judge. I don't know. There's no way for me to know that. I wasn't there when he made the proffer statements. What I did was present his position at the time we were preparing for sentencing, at the time we were preparing, I should say, for plea.
It's very disreputable conduct.
I'm sorry, what is?
You say to him, look, you know, you signed this proffer.
You said
it was completely truthful.
Your Honor, you know
now
I can't...
Now what's going on?
You know I can't get into the conversation I had with him. I can't do that. That's covered by the attorney-client privilege. No, I can't.
It's certainly not going to be interpreted in your favor.
The bottom line here is, Judge, the statements made by counsel to government counsel in pursuit of a plea agreement here were not adopted by the defendant.
Your email is a representation of what your client believes. That's contrary to the proffer agreement.
That is true, Your Honor. I don't dispute that. What I do dispute is the fact that that email communication can be used to trigger this proffer because it's not within a judicial proceeding, which is where I think it needs to be according to a strict construction of this agreement. And I also believe those...
He takes a position in the email contrary to his proffer agreement. I think the government can tear up the proffer agreement.
That's where my position is different, Judge. I think the proffer agreement's term suggests it has to be within a judicial proceeding. And if there aren't other questions, I'll reserve whatever time I have left.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sharda?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mina Sharda for the United States. The District Court properly held that the proffer agreement was breached by the defendant, that the relevant conduct of 33.9 grams of crack cocaine should have been assessed against the defendant, that there should have been a two-level enhancement for his role in the offense, and he should not have received acceptance of responsibility. I would note for the court that the proffer agreement was breached at the moment at which the defendant objected to the pre-sentence investigation report. The defendant claims that the probation department relied on his proffer protected statements to enhance his sentence under relevant conduct. That's not correct, Your Honors. The probation department explicitly stated that there was about five or six paragraphs that were proffer protected paragraphs, or proffer protected statements, and then went on to credit Ms. Hill's testimony as to the 33.9 grams of crack cocaine. In fact, Ms. Hill had crack cocaine from Mr. Green and had crack cocaine from Mr. Bennett and Mr. Kelly. That 180 grams of crack cocaine that she indicated was Mr. Green's was never assessed against the defendant. However, when she said that 33.9 grams of crack cocaine was Mr. Bennett's, that's what the court and the probation department assessed as relevant conduct against the defendant. The breach occurred when the defendant decided to file objections to the PSR. Had the defendant merely said these statements shouldn't be used against him at sentencing, that would have been sufficient and there probably would not have been any breach. But the moment he decided to say that all of the admissible evidence suggests that Mr. Bennett is a marijuana and MDMA dealer and does not deal in other substances, or when he said there was no evidence that this cocaine belonged to Mr. Bennett or that he even knew about the cocaine, he breached the proffer. And at that moment, the government could then also use the proffer protected statements to demonstrate that that was the crack cocaine that belonged to him. In addition, Ms. Hill indicated that she had been, when she was being beaten, that the defendant was asking for the money for the crack cocaine, for the marijuana, and for the MDMA. Your Honors, based on that and based on what Ms. Hill had indicated, that the relevant conduct portion of the enhancement was appropriate. It was clear that it was a jointly undertaken criminal activity. Mr. Kelly and Mr. Bennett used Ms. Hill to transport the drugs. The drugs were supposed to get back to the two individuals once they got to Madison, Wisconsin, and then eventually presumably sold on the streets. In addition, the court had found that while Mr. Bennett was beating Ms. Hill, he was ultimately asked for about $12,000, which if you did the math in terms of the MDMA and the marijuana that was there, it couldn't have been enough. That he was also asking, obviously, for the crack cocaine, and it was clearly he was helping enforce to get that money. Your Honors, the acceptance of responsibility argument.
Are you saying that when he's beating her, he's saying to her, I demand you pay me for the, you know, the marijuana, the pot, and the ecstasy, and when I'm done beating you, Kelly's going to come over here and beat you for the crack?
No, Your Honor. If I said that, I apologize. When he's beating her, he's asking for all of it, for the money, for the crack, for the ecstasy, and for the marijuana. Ultimately, when Sweet Lou, who is a undercover DEA agent, ends up trying to get Ms. Hill and the money to Mr. Bennett, there was about $12,000 that they were asking for. In terms of the acceptance of responsibility arguments, Your Honor, the defendant was, as the court knows, in an absconder status for about 4 years. At the time he then gets picked up by law enforcement, he gives a false name and thus continues his obstructive conduct. And so from the government's position, he gets his two-level enhancement for obstruction of justice and then does not also accept responsibility because in part of that conduct, and therefore the court properly held that he should not have gotten a reduction for acceptance of responsibility. Unless the court has any other questions, the government asks the court to affirm the sentence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Shard. Mr. Brindley, anything further?
Yes, Your Honor. The government identified the point of breach by Mr. Bennett as occurring when he raised his objections to the pre-sentence report. That occurred after the protected statements had been cited in the probation officer's pre-sentence investigation report, and pursuant to Farmer, I don't think that can serve as the breach. And as a result of that, I think that his protected statements were used, the contract was breached before he made those objections. After it was breached, and he could object any way he chose.
Did anyone ever argue to the court that the proffered statements should not appear at all in the PSR without saying anything about the fact that he now disagreed that the crack belonged to him?
What we argued to the court was that the proffer statements should be protected and shouldn't be usable at the sentencing in any way. I don't know if we put it in terms of it should be stricken from the pre-sentence report, but we said you can't consider these at all for various reasons. And the court said, well, because you filed these objections, that was breach. And it's our position now that pursuant to Farmer, that can't be breach because they breached first. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brindley. And you were appointed, Lena.
Thank you.
Thank you.